From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A poll out today shows Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in a dead heat in the closely watched state of New Hampshire. The WBUR poll found Trump leads Clinton by 1 point. Clinton was leading by 3 in October.
And the presidential race was a big topic in last night's New Hampshire Senate debate between Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte and Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan. Hassan criticized Ayotte for waffling on her support of Donald Trump.
And she can try to distance herself, as she did on multiple occasions when she was asked whether she supported Donald Trump. But in fact, she said on 35 different occasions that she supported him. She called him a role model for our children. And then when the political winds seemed to change, that's when she changed her position.
And here was Senator Ayotte's response.
She has not stepped away from Hillary Clinton on one thing. I've actually taken the action of saying that I'm not going to be voting for our nominee because I am concerned about the actions that he has talked about in tapes. And she certainly is not going to stand up to Hillary Clinton on behalf of any. If she can't call her out on this private email server, when is she ever going to call her out?
That debate hosted by WMUR and the New Hampshire Union Leader. Joining us now for our Senate tracker is Josh Rogers, senior political reporter and editor for NHPR. He's in Concord. Hi, Josh.
How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing well. And it sounds like neither of these candidates want to be tied all that closely to the people at the top of the ticket.
I think you picked up on something, Jeremy. This has been going on all campaign long, certainly more aggressively from Democrat Maggie Hassan trying to yoke Kelly Ayotte to Trump. Obviously, her relationship with Trump has been tortured. She first said she was going to support but not endorse, support but not tell other people to vote for him. She walked further away from him post the Access Hollywood tape, and then she said she'd write in Mike Pence. But Democrats believe that Donald Trump can drag Kelly Ayotte down.
Has it helped or hurt her to finally say after that Access Hollywood tape, she's not going to vote for him?
Hard to say. I mean, she's definitely been helped by Hillary Clinton's issues with the FBI. That's allowed her to kind of turn this back on Maggie Hassan. And, you know, Maggie Hassan's been an unabashed and not always articulate, but certainly unapologetic supporter of Hillary Clinton from the very beginning. And, you know, as is common in New Hampshire, the Democrats are really running as a team. Anytime Hillary Clinton's here, Maggie Hassan is at her side. And, you know, Kelly Ayotte's really been having to go it alone, not simply because of Trump, but because of differences with others on the ticket up here. Congressman Frank Gintis, Kelly Ayotte had wanted him to resign over a campaign finance scandal. So, you know, this race has been shaping up to kind of Kelly Ayotte kind of going it alone, Maggie Hassan running as a sort of team Democrat. Both of them very much you know, the outcome is going to be dependent on what happens at the top of the ticket. And right now that's tightening, which probably, you know, augurs to Ayotte's benefit.
Can we just back up a second? Because Kelly Ayotte, a year ago, before this campaign really got going, was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party. Maggie Hassan, a young governor in New Hampshire. Do people in New Hampshire like both of these people, or are they disliked by the voters?
They are both pretty well liked, and they're both real talents within New Hampshire politics and national politics. In some ways, their stature within their parties can be seen as sort of equivalent. I mean, Maggie Hassan has been elected twice governor. She's seen as somebody, in the mold of Jean Shaheen, who was a governor and now serves in the U.S. Senate. Kelly Ayotte, you know, you rightly know, was seen as a rising star, you know, talked about as a vice president for Mitt Romney. I mean, how seriously one wants to take that is, you know, reasonable. But, you know, there's been so much money poured into this race, more than $100 million in outside money will be spent. That it's going to translate to more than $150 a vote. And, you know, national political infrastructure has, you know, and outside groups have a lot of money invested in these two people.
Josh, you know New Hampshire better than anyone. Let me ask you this. Is this race really close, or does one of them have the edge? And the same question with the presidential race. It's so funny. You see some polls where they're really tight and some where Hillary Clinton has a pretty good lead in New Hampshire.
Well, I think it feels quite tight. I mean, there was a poll, I don't know, a couple weeks ago that showed Clinton up 15. A lot of people here, including me, discounted that as an outlier. feels very tight. It's worth knowing that Democrats tend to do well here during presidential years. They've won 5 out of the last 6, and Democrats tend to have better ground organization. But New Hampshire is where Donald Trump won big in the primary, and the state's definitely crucial to his chances, if he could win this. And so, he's coming back Monday night, and Kelly Ayotte's fortunes, whether she likes it or not, are going to be tied to Donald Trump to some extent. I mean, she's outpolled him, but if Hillary Clinton manages to beat Trump here by, north of 5 points, it may be tough for Ayotte.
That's Josh Rogers, senior political reporter and editor for NHPR, New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, to Washington State now, where earlier this week, 6-year-old Daniel Ramirez of Bellingham died from a mysterious ailment, a sudden paralysis that has potentially now affected 9 children in Washington State. Does that sound familiar? Well, there was a similar outbreak of mysterious paralysis in California in 2014 and one in Britain last year. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is investigating the Washington outbreak. So far, 2 of the 9 cases have been confirmed to be acute flaccid myelitis, a rare neurologic syndrome that causes polio-like symptoms. Dr. Catherine Otten is a pediatric neurologist at Seattle Children's Hospital. She's been involved with some of the cases. Of course, she can't identify the children, but what can she tell us about this outbreak? Dr. Otten, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
We know that there's continued testing, but 2 of the children have been confirmed with this syndrome. Tell us more about it. What is it?
Acute flaccid myelitis is a very rare neurologic syndrome, and symptoms generally include weakness in arms or legs or both. Symptoms can also include weakness of the face or eyes, but that's less common. And this can range from mild weakness to inability to move the limb or absence of movement in the limb.
And how do you get it, though?
It is not a contagious syndrome, and I think that's very important to keep in mind. We do think that this may be a rare reaction to common viruses, but the CDC is still investigating, and as of today, the cause is still not known.
Is there anything about where these children came from across the state or their ages that gives you any clues?
We haven't identified a link that links all of the 9 patients that we have reported. It's also important to keep in mind that these patients were reported because the CDC asks us to cast a very wide net, and we report any cases that meet some basic criteria. But this doesn't actually mean that all reports will be confirmed cases. Mm. That being said, the cases we've reported have ranged from toddlers up to teenagers, and they come from several areas across the state. 5 counties in total. There are some unique features that do distinguish them, so we have not been able to identify a link between them, but the CDC and the Department of Health are certainly investigating this possibility.
Well, can you tell us, do they perhaps share a vulnerability, an allergy, or anything like that? Is there anything you can share with us?
We do think that acute flaccid myelitis may be a rare reaction to common viruses, viruses that many of us catch and cause a very mild respiratory illness. The chances that someone will go on to develop acute flaccid myelitis is incredibly rare, less than 1 in a million.
So perhaps there's some link among these patients as to why they were those, each of them 1 in a million, if in fact they all have this syndrome. Meantime, what can parents do if it's just a virus? That there's lots of those out there.
That's a great question, and I understand that parents are probably wondering, should they be alarmed? I think the important thing to remember is that acute flaccid myelitis itself is not a contagious syndrome. It isn't transmissible from patient to patient. Common viruses that have been purported to be related to or associated with acute flaccid myelitis may be contagious. And so in that case, I think the best prevention techniques would include good hand hygiene, making sure your children are washing their hands, keeping their vaccinations up to date, and the kind of basic infection prevention techniques that their pediatrician recommends.
Can you name the viruses? Not that people normally say, oh, I have the enterovirus or whatever it is, but you just said that these are viruses that cause, usually stomach upset. So can you name them?
I can tell you that there was a prior cluster in the Rocky Mountain region around 2014 that coincided with an outbreak of a virus called enterovirus. Mm-hmm. This is a very common virus, though, and testing by the CDC and a very extensive investigation did not consistently show a link between enterovirus and this cluster, but because of the timing, there was suspected to be an association. The CDC has been doing a wide range of testing on all of these patients, and so far we haven't found a consistent germ or a consistent infection that links the cases that we've seen throughout the last several years.
Right. So right now it's a detective story, but also a profoundly sad one for the family of a six-year-old, Daniel Ramirez, who's died from something that hasn't been confirmed yet, mysterious ailment. Dr. Catherine Otten, again, a pediatric neurologist who's been working with some of these cases of potential acute flaccid myelitis at Seattle Children's Hospital in Washington State. What happens inside a hospital when this happens? Are you bracing for more? Are you rushing to all re-educate yourself about this? What happens?
Well, we have a lot of expertise in treating conditions like acute flaccid myelitis, but I can tell you that these patients develop symptoms outside the hospital and then presented to Seattle Children's for care. And we certainly want to be ready if there are more cases. And we've been working very closely with the Department of Health and CDC to help in their investigation.
Yeah. Dr. Otten, thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to speak now with two people painfully on the front lines of the debate over deporting 11 million undocumented immigrants. We start with Andy Ostroy. In November 2006, his wife, Adrienne Shelley, the actress and writer behind the hit film Waitress, was murdered by a construction worker living in the U.S. illegally. He told police they'd had an argument. He feared Adrienne Shelley would have him deported, so he killed her. He's now been sentenced to prison for 25 years and is scheduled to be deported to his native Ecuador. You'd think Andy, who was left to raise their two-year-old daughter, would be calling to deport all undocumented immigrants before they commit such crimes. He's not. And he recently wrote an op-ed about it in the New York Times. Andy, welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for speaking to us about this, because I'm sure it's still very raw. But, you know, the immediate question is, why not? Why aren't you in the camp that says, yes, my wife was murdered by an undocumented immigrant. He should have been deported. He should never be here. Why not say that?
Well, because it would be an oversimplification of a very complicated situation. I think there's a lot of dangerous rhetoric that has been thrown around in this campaign, particularly by Donald Trump. The scapegoating of immigrants on a wholesale level is just not something I've subscribed to.
Well, you write that Adrienne wasn't killed by an illegal immigrant per se. These are your words, that she was a victim of a depraved killer who happened to be an illegal immigrant. But it sounds like the whole reason that he did kill her was that he was undocumented and he was afraid she'd have him deported. You know, can you really uncouple the terrible murder from his status?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. One, there were no witnesses. So we really, to this day, we don't really know what happened. He also could have just had jail as a fear or getting caught as a fear.
Well, you also say that saying that, subscribing everything that happened to the fact that he was undocumented, dilutes the bigger truth, which is that he didn't have any respect for human life.
Look, the truth is he was, in my opinion, destined for a life of crime in one way or another, regardless of whether he committed those crimes in America or in Ecuador or anywhere else.
Well, that's the point that Donald Trump and his supporters make, that these people do commit crimes, although he broad brushes. He says 2 million undocumented immigrants have been convicted of crimes. But you point out that according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's actually closer to 176,000.
The facts just don't support his rhetoric. It's designed to toss buckets of red meat and chum to his base. To the contrary, when you do look at statistics and facts, Americans have much more to fear from their fellow Americans than they do from undocumented immigrants.
And your point is, with the statistics, that 176,000 is sort of a drop in the bucket. We're a country of over 300 million. But what do you say to people who also have lost loved ones to undocumented immigrants? Wendy Hartling comes to mind. Her daughter was killed by someone who'd been jailed for attempted murders, and the U.S. couldn't send him back to Haiti, tried to send him back and couldn't because Haiti wouldn't accept him. And she feels it's Congress that's not doing its job.
Well, there's a fair argument to be made that our judicial system doesn't do its job in fully protecting our citizens. We absolutely need better border control. We need immigration reform desperately. We need to deport criminals who are arrested for committing major crimes. I'm a proponent of all of that, but I am not ready to take the leap from that to, and therefore, immigrants are at the heart of the problem.
But have you always seen things this way? I'm wondering if in, you know, maybe your darkest moments, this was a horrific crime. And I'm wondering if, you know, late at night, there hasn't been a, you know, fist-pounding moment of, why was that guy even here?
Well, of course. I mean, I'm human. And, you know, in the period right after, I asked the question why in many ways and frequently. But, you know, we all ask questions and then rationale and logic kick in, hopefully, after a few seconds. And you realize that, that is not the answer. I need an answer, but that's not it.
Do people assume things about you, that you're going to be part of the campaign on the other side of this issue?
I have been contacted over the years by the far right wanting to spoon feed me into that debate. I always put it off. I never wanted to be an emotional sidebar for a radio or TV program, because there's something really dangerous happening in our country right now. We have, I think, the biggest, most important election in my lifetime. And I think people who are on the alt-right side of this are not going to be persuaded by me or anybody else. You know, I still believe in America, and I still believe in my fellow Americans, and I still believe in rational thinking. And I believe that there's a lot of people who are, if they're still a little bit undecided, that they can be persuaded by what's right and wrong. And it's just not right to do and say the things that Donald Trump says.
What kind of reaction have you gotten? This is a vicious political season. And what kind of, I mean, what do you hear?
If you email me, I'll send you a couple of screen grabs of my Twitter account. But, you know, I take the good with the bad, and there's been an awful lot of good. I just hope something, you know, good comes of it from me trying to say, hey, look, if this can happen to me and I can feel this way, then it should be easier for the rest of you. So we'll see.
Andy Astroy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's bring in Wendy Hartling. In June 2015, her beautiful 25-year-old daughter, Casey Chadwick, was killed by a man from Haiti living in this country illegally. But her very sad story is different from Andy's, in that this was after the murderer had served time in this country for attempted murder, and after Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, tried to deport him three times. But as she discovered, if countries refuse to take criminal immigrants back, those criminals are often released after serving time. Up to 20,000 a year are. Wendy Hartling joins us from WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. Wendy, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, we're so sorry for your loss. And then this discovery. What did you think when you heard that your daughter's murderer had served time and hadn't been deported?
It was the worst time of my life, especially since this person. Now, I know all of Casey and I were very close, and I was very close to all of her friends, so I know this person was not her close friend, as he claimed.
Well, so this compounds your pain. Now, we know this man who murdered your daughter was sentenced to 60 years in prison this summer for that,
yes.
But small consolation, I'm sure.
Yes.
So, in the investigation that ensued, it was also discovered that ICE could not deport him because Haiti wouldn't accept him, but didn't tell the State Department that Haiti refused to take this man back because they feared that the State Department would only get involved if he was a terrorist. So the ball was potentially dropped there. But, you know, others have said there are so many laws and restrictions tying hands. If countries won't take people back,
if they're not going to take them back, then stop helping these countries. Stop sending them, giving them visas. Stop everything.
Others have said this, this idea of cut aid, cut visas to these countries that won't take these criminal undocumented immigrants back. But there is a bill sitting in the House Judiciary Committee for a year. It would allow the U.S. to continue to detain some immigrants, but it's sitting in committee. Have you wanted to say to them, pass that law?
Yes, I do. It needs to be passed. You know, I belong to this group called the Remembrance Project. It's a very important group. It's non-profit. And I went to Texas to a convention, and it was all angel moms and dads. Every one of us had lost a loved one to an illegal criminal alien. It's a group, the club nobody wants to join.
Yeah, you do not want to be a member. But
right.
candidate Donald Trump was there.
Yes.
You support him.
Yes, I do. I do now. And I'm a registered Democrat, have been a Democrat forever. But this time he's got my vote. He has mentioned my daughter twice in two of his rallies. He's done so much with the Remembrance Project that there's no possible way I would vote for anybody else. Because I have not heard one word from Hillary about any of this.
Well, but as you all know, once people dive into the complicated relationship that the U.S. has with other countries over the issue of immigrants, there's probably little that a Donald Trump can do if people are unwilling to cut visas or change laws so that you could detain more immigrants after they've served time. Right now, by law, you can't.
Aunt Casey's killer was let go the day he got out. ICE had him that day, and ICE let him go that day.
But they had to because their hands were tied by the—
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly where we need politicians and everything to concentrate on. They have to concentrate on fixing these laws.
Well, but what do you make of what we just heard from Andy Ostroy, who, you know, lost his beloved wife? You both have that same pain. But he says if he can find some compassion for immigrants living illegal in the U.S., and he says, you know, most of them are not criminals, not murderers. We can't broad brush here. Then surely others can because of what he's been through.
I understand where he's coming from. I have a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that nothing's going to happen. But this whole situation with me having my daughter taken from me so horribly, it just made me decide I'm going to fight. I'm just going to – I'll do whatever I can to help and to ensure that these laws that we have are either made better or enforced better. We were all immigrants at one time or another. So my beef isn't with all immigrants. It's just the ones that come over here and they commit heinous crimes and they maybe go to jail, maybe don't. Maybe they just disappear, never to be seen of again.
Yeah. Wendy Hartling, again, her daughter Casey Chadwick, was killed by an undocumented immigrant that ICE had tried to deport three times. Mm-hmm. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series!
Sounds from Fox from what feels like just a couple hours ago as the Chicago Cubs and Cleveland go into extra innings in, I don't know, one of the most exciting games ever. The Cubs beating the Indians 8-7 in 10 innings in Cleveland, their first championship since 1908. The Indians now take over as the franchise with the longest title drought. Their last win, World Series win, 1948. Sorry, guys. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. So, Mike, just one question here. Was this one of the greatest games ever? You just go, I'll tell you when to stop.
It felt that way. It felt that way emotionally. And isn't it a nice thing that such a great game delivers almost the exact amount of endorphins to counter the exhaustion that one gets by staying up in a rain delayed past midnight in the East? I know that there's such a thing as a recency bias, and this is why 2 weeks ago people were tweeting that Tom Hanks as David S. Pumpkin was the greatest SNL sketch ever, and it wasn't Landshark was certainly better. But how could you gainsay anyone who said, I got everything I ever wanted out of a baseball game in this one? And certainly if you're a Cubs fan or a person with a bleeding heart or a person from not Northeast Ohio or anyone who ever rooted for the underdog, this actual game delivered a lot. And I would also say that the story of the Cubs, if you know nothing, I mean nothing about sports, but have been in America for 2 or 3 years, you probably knew two things, and that's the Yankees are a good team and the Cubs have never won. Well, now it's not 108 years since the Cubs last won a World Series. It's about 12 hours.
Well, and, you know, they came alive. I mean, the Cubs had a lead last night. You know, they just came alive. But then Cleveland came back and then they tie it up. I mean, and it seemed very physical to me. Was there a lot of sliding and bashing into people?
Well, yeah, there were takeout slides that have been illegalized that weren't called in the game that maybe could have been. But in such a big situation, perhaps you look the other way on that. And there were balls bouncing all over the place. And the Cubs, you could tell there was a lot of tension. And another very unusual thing that happened was their great, great closer, who was used rightly. Joe Maddon, the Cubs manager, was criticized for using Aroldis Chapman in Game 6 when he didn't need to be used. He seemed a little tired. Now, a little tired for him is instead of 101-mile-an-hour fastball, he's throwing a 97-mile-an-hour fastball. But you know what? That fastball was jacked for a home run. And I saw an interesting statistic that tying home run was the fastest pitch an Indians player had hit for a home run all year. So all these unusual things were happening. Most unusual of all is the Cubs winning the World Series.
It's just very, very to them. But look, the Indians, we have to tip the cap to them, don't we?
Corey Kluber's their best pitcher. He tried to get 3 wins in a World Series. Their second best pitcher was injured before this season. So if there's a likely entrant from the American League in the World Series next year, it's them. But we should say the nature of baseball is the word likely doesn't mean a lot. I know the Cubs went into the postseason as the likeliest team to win, but it was still unlikely. It was still only a 25% chance. And then when they went down 3-1, they had maybe, you know, a 15% chance of coming back, but they did it.
Mike Pesca, one last thought from this series, just the feel of it, the sound of it.
Every team, every fan base that wins a World Series, it's so exuberant. But I just think of concentric circles around Chicago, not just even physical or geographic, but psychological. And that's where this one had the hugest impact. Obviously, the Cubs fans are delighted and beside themselves. But in a way, so is everyone who's ever rooted or understood what it meant to be an underdog.
Yeah. We put a lot of hope in those players on the field. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, the Central Bank of Egypt said it would float its local currency in an attempt to eliminate a black market for U.S. dollars. The Egyptian pound fell by almost half. The reason the central bank did this was to get a much-needed $12 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund. Egypt's economy has been a disaster ever since 2011, when former President Hosni Mubarak was overthrown. Joining us now from Cairo is NPR's Jane Araf. And Jane, tell us more about this decision to devalue the currency. What kind of impact is that going to have?
Hopefully, it should make things easier for ordinary Egyptians who have really been struggling trying to buy basic things, and that includes sugar and rice and basic food. The country is in the midst of an economic crisis, so this devaluation was meant to narrow the gap between what the Egyptian currency was trading for in the black market and what the official rate was. That gap was so big that businesses basically didn't want to trade dollars. And it meant that the Egyptian government was having a hard time importing goods. It imports most of the food here, and that's caused a crisis in the market.
I've also read that the IMF has a real incentive to offer this $12 billion loan to Egypt because it doesn't want Egypt to end up like some of the neighboring countries where a lot of refugees are trying to get into Europe. They want to stabilize the Egyptian economy.
They absolutely do. Now, Egypt is the biggest country in terms of population in the Middle East. It's got 80 million people, and 20 million of those are between the ages of 18 and 29. So it is a group of people, a potential workforce that could have a lot of potential, but without jobs and with a terrible economy, more of them are going to do what they've been doing, which is taking to boats and some of them dying to try to reach Europe for a better life. So the U.S. is interested in Egyptian stability because of the economy and also because politically Egypt needs to be stable. It's next to Israel. It signed a peace treaty with Israel. It is one of the traditional power brokers in the Middle East, and it's hugely important to whatever happens in this region, in the Middle East and North Africa. Now, it's been consumed with its own problems ever since the Arab Spring and the revolutions that have followed that, but it is still seen as a very important country and one that everyone is interested in trying to help stabilize.
How politically stable is it now?
If you ask the government, there's absolutely no question there. They have done things like ban protests. We were speaking with some Egyptian officials yesterday, and they said, well, nobody asks to protest. The fact is that if they asked, they would not be allowed to do it. That doesn't mean there isn't discontent here, but what it does mean is the country is, again, under very tight control. So there was that Arab Spring when people took to the streets, starting in Tunisia and then in other countries, and they actually got rid of governments, authoritarian governments, that had been around for decades. That was the case here in Egypt. So that president, Hosni Mubarak, was replaced by another one, democratically elected. But he was basically toppled by the military. And the president now, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is actually an army general. So superficially, it is quite stable. Nobody expects another revolution. People don't seem to be in the mood to rise up again. But it does have very serious, crushing problems, a lot of them tied to the economy, and that's worrying a lot of people.
And ever since the overthrow of former President Hosni Mubarak, Egypt has been suffering when it comes to tourism, which is something that got even worse after the passenger plane that was bombed last year, departing from Sharm el-Sheikh, and an Egypt Air flight that crashed into the Mediterranean Sea earlier this year, after a fire on board, perhaps scaring away even more tourists. How is tourism doing in Egypt now?
It's not doing very well. I was at the Egyptian Museum just a few days ago. That's the museum with King Tut's tomb in it, all those golden treasures. And normally it would be full of tourists, including Americans and Western Europeans, but it was almost empty. A lot of that is because since the Arab Spring, since revolutions have swept this region, there has been a general concern about security, and people aren't coming to the region in general. But Egypt specifically, for some of those reasons that you mentioned, has had a hard time. Tourism is down at least 40% from last year. And it's not just Americans, although I did run into Americans at the Egyptian Museum, a small group of them, and they said they felt perfectly safe here. But that perception persists. So a lot of the tourists who replaced Americans and Europeans are Eastern Europeans and people from countries like China, India, and Japan. And those numbers are down as well.
Not that I'm trying to pile on to the problems that exist in Egypt, but can you tell us about the flooding that's going on with the Nile? Because it sounds like that's a problem as well.
It has been a huge problem for some parts of the country. In four of Egypt's provinces, there were flash floods that led to the deaths of at least 29 people. Now, this is seasonal flooding, and you might remember from your history books that actually the seasonal flooding of the Nile River was what led to the great civilizations, the Egyptian civilization that sprung up along the banks of the Nile, because when it flooded, it left behind silt, which fertilized the soil. So all of that stopped decades ago when they built a huge dam, but the flooding, which is caused by rains, still continues, and the Egyptian government isn't really prepared to deal with it. On top of that, it's created a water problem. Here in Cairo, if you look at the Nile, you'll see it's all brown and muddy from the silt in it. And in many places, it's affected the drinking water, although that's a perennial problem, and a lot of Egyptians don't have clean drinking water in general.
Can you leave us with something uplifting about Egypt today?
Gosh, you know, wherever you are in the Middle East, no matter how bad it gets, I find that what's uplifting is that people actually still go out, they try to make a living, they take care of their families. And because Cairo is a huge cosmopolitan city, sort of like the New York City of the Middle East, it's much more so like that here. Even now when things are grim and people are having a very hard time getting by, there still really is a vibrancy here because it takes a lot to extinguish hope altogether. When I was out in the market today, in one of these markets where people were waiting for boxes of food, subsidized food from the military, and the military ran out. You could see these people, a lot of them old people, with their hands stretched out, holding crumpled bills that they wanted to try to pay for these boxes of cheap food, going away empty-handed. And when I talked to some of them later and asked them if they thought it would get better, they kind of thought that eventually it would, that it might take a long time, but eventually they were hoping that things would get better. And so the fact that there's still hope here is not a bad thing.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf joining us from Cairo, Egypt. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in addition to Egypt, the next president of the United States will also face a series of other foreign policy challenges, from Afghanistan, where two more U.S. service members were killed today, to Iraq, where the effort to retake the city of Mosul from ISIS continues, to North Korea, which retired Navy Admiral James Stavridis told us recently is the biggest foreign policy challenge. Yesterday, I asked former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel if he agreed.
Well, I'm not sure I'd make that the biggest challenge, but I think any time a nation is at war, and we are at war, by the way, we have boots on the ground in about five countries that are in hostile action right now, including Afghanistan. That's got to be a priority for a president of the United States. Anytime your country is involved in shooting wars and you have casualties, and we are taking casualties, I mean, that seems to me the first priority. North Korea is a priority. It's an important priority, but it's certainly the Middle East. China's behavior and activities in the East and South China Sea. It's our economy. It's trade. It's putting a Congress hopefully together that works with a president to actually start governing. We haven't governed in this country for a long time. We didn't even pass an appropriations bill this year, which is astounding to me. We haven't passed budgets in years. When I got to the Senate 20 years ago, those were just responsibilities and things you did because you were there for a higher purpose, was to help govern. And you compromised and you worked with people. We've allowed politics to get personal, and we vilify each other, and we've got to stop that. But the foreign policy challenges are immense, and they are interconnected, and the president is not going to have any time on this, the new president. They're going to have to get right into it.
Former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel speaking with us yesterday. You can hear more of our interview at hereandnow.org.
African-American farmers have long faced hurdles when it comes to growing food. Racist lending practices, lost land, and aging population have led to questions about whether the black farm even has a future. One answer might be found in the city. Sandhya Dirks from Here Now contributor KQED reports.
This is the story of two farmers from very different worlds.
For the longest time, I looked up on how you say urban gardeners or farmers are just a fad. They don't produce much, and they just, you know, just doing something they say they.
That's Ben Burkett. He's a fourth-generation rural farmer from Mississippi. He's still planting some of the same okra seed pods passed down through his family.
The story is that a young lady was captured in West Africa, and she was brought to, they call it New Iberia, sold into slavery. And she held those pods of okra in her hand all the way across the Atlantic Ocean.
He thought it was just family folklore until he visited West Africa.
And I look at the pods they had in the pods I grow. It's a little fat pod, still a long slender. I said, might be a little truth to this story.
Burkett has a working wisdom of how to sow and reap, a wisdom not written down in books, but held in his hands. And as young people move to cities and away from farms, he has fewer future generations to pass his wisdom on to.
Most of the young people trying to leave the farm, and these young people trying to come to the farm.
He's talking about young people like Kelly Carlisle. She grew up far from the Mississippi Delta in Oakland, California.
My parents were street vendors, and from, you know, age 13, I knew that I wanted to be in an office.
Carlisle got that office job in the first dot-com boom, but when the boom went bust, she lost it. One day, unemployed and looking for air conditioning, she stumbled into a nursery and spotted a lemon tree. She didn't know how things grew. She thought,
who would tie this giant lemon on this tiny little tree?
She says it seemed like a kind of magic.
I actually bought the lemon tree to dare it to do it again. And within a month, we had two more lemons. And I mean, that was when I knew. That was when I was like, I love everything about this. What else can I grow?
So Carlisle started her own farm, a small one, just a quarter acre in Oakland. Carlisle still had a lot to learn about farming. So she started trying to find other farmers, other black farmers. One place she found them, the Black Urban Growers Conference, known as BUGS. Last year, she helped bring the conference to Oakland. It was at BUGS where she first met Ben Burkett.
I was telling him how, you know, our collards don't do well in the summertime. You know, they go to seed very quickly. And he's like, well, I always use the light of the moon cycles to grow in. And I started laughing. I laughed in his face. You know, I'm like, that's not real. Who does that? Like, you're some kind of Wiccan out there, like, oh, the moon is full, you know, like using your life's blood to plant collard greens. No, that's not real.
Side note,
it's real. It's a meet cute kind of moment, the brand new urban farmer laughing at the folksy wisdom of the old timer. But Carlisle is the first to admit how much she needs Burkett and farmers like him. They might be polar opposites, one rural, the other urban, but they are both Black farmers, and that binds them together.
I used to liken farming and fava beans and kale with Pilates. You know, who do you see doing Pilates? it doesn't look like us.
Carlisle says the conversation around organic farming and sustainability has customarily been pretty white, led by mostly white voices.
I don't have anything to say to Michael Pollan or Joel Salatin or Mark Bittman. I don't have anything to say to those guys. You know, they have their place, and kudos to you for making white people eat better.
But for Black people to eat better, they have to combat stigma from all sides.
It's certainly not just from white men and white women, you know. It's also from my own people, you know.
Remember those collard greens Burkett was advising Carlisle on?
I once had a bumper crop of collard greens. And I went to one of our neighbors here in the neighborhood, and I was like, Miss, you know, this entire bag, it's yours. Please, you know, do you want any collard greens? And she recoiled from me, and she's, no, where did you get that? And I was like, I got it from my farm, which is right here in your neighborhood. And she said, you say you got a farm back there? I was like, yeah, I'm a farmer. She says, oh, girl, no. Why would you call yourself that? That's terrible.
But Carlisle is proud to call herself a farmer, even though her farm is tiny. She dreams, she says, of one day having real acreage outside the city. But first, she wants to make organic food, farm-to-table food, something that's available and desirable for those in her neighborhood, too. That's one big reason her farm doubles as a camp and after-school program, where she teaches kids to farm, passing on lessons, just like her Southern counterpart, Ben Burkett, did for her.
I'm going to do what I can to pass on the knowledge and the wisdom, and even if they want to come to Mississippi.
Together, these two farmers are connecting okra pods that traveled on slave ships from West Africa to drugstore lemon trees to create a future for the Black farm. For Here and Now, I'm Sandhya Dirks in Oakland.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.